Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead. Halloween is creeping up on us, so what better time to get a little spooky? We'll be discussing our favourite ghost stories. But first, we meet Andrew Michael Hurley, whose career itself appears to have a touch of the supernatural to it. His first book, The Loney, was published in 2014 in a limited edition of just 278 copies by a small press who decided to take a punt on a debut novelist with a keen eye for the gothic. But there was something in the air. It was picked up by a bigger publisher and promptly went on to win the Costa First Book Award. Needless to say, breath is bated, pulses are racing at the prospect of his second novel, Devil's Day. Set again in a bleak and wet part of Hurley's Lancashire, the novel follows a young man and his new wife as they return to his home village to take part in the ritual of the book's title. When Hurley joined Sian Kane in the studio, he began with a reading.
One late October day, just over a century ago, the farmers of the Endlands went to gather their sheep from the moors as they did every autumn. Only this year, while the shepherds were pulling a pair of wayward lambs from a peat bog, the devil killed one of the ewes and tore off her fleece to hide himself among the flock. Down in the farmlands, he flitted from one house to the next, too crafty to be caught, only manifesting what he infected. He was the maggot in the eye of the good dog, the cancer that rotted the ram's gonads, the blood in the baby's milk. The stories began to reach the ears of the villagers in Underclough further up the valley, and while they were not surprised or sorry to hear that the heathen folk of the Endlands were being persecuted by the old fella, they petitioned their minister to do something for their own sake. But he was frail and elderly, and unwilling to tackle the devil on his own, he asked the bishop for an assistant, by which he meant a substitute. The priest who arrived with his crucifix and aspergillum was a young man sceptical of his summons. He would think of himself as a missionary, he decided, a bringer of light to this dark valley. These people were no better than the gullible savages of the colonies, who found spirits in everything from the clouds to the dirt. They deserved his pity. But when he saw the animals decaying before his eyes, and the blood dribbling from the wet nurse's teat, his nerve faltered, and the devil brought a blizzard to the valley that lasted for days. The cottages in the village choked under drifts that grew to the windows, and stores of wood and peat that should have lasted all winter were quickly gone. Across the bridge, the church was lightless and cowed, and in the graveyard the dead were buried a second time, as a bigger swell of snow blew down the valley and across the farmlands. Man and beast were forced to share the same warmth. Piglets and gun dogs slept on the hearthrugs. The tup steamed in the kitchen. Days were late to lighten and quick to end, and people began to die. The older folk first, coughing up their lungs in shreds like tomato skins. And then the children, burning with fever. But the worst of it, the very worst of it, they said, was that it was impossible to know who the devil would visit next. He left no footprints in the snow. There was no knock at the door. It was as if, they said, he was the air itself, the stuff they breathed. The villagers of Underclough blamed the farmers of the Endlands, and the farmers began to wonder if they brought it upon themselves, if there'd been some sign that they'd missed and left to fester like an open wound. Hadn't a jackdaw flown into the Kerwin's house one evening in the summer and clubbed itself to death on the walls? Hadn't the dyer's children seen a hare digging up bones in the graveyard? Then there was that warm Saturday in September when Joe Pentecost, drunk on port and pride, dropped his glass as he made the toast at his daughter's wedding breakfast. They'd all laughed at him, forgiven him his moment of clumsiness, and thought nothing of it. Yet now they argued over the ritual that would have sponged away their bad luck with a spilled wine. But no one could remember what to do. Only fragments of old cautionary stories came to mind that made them throw their cats out into the snow and sprinkle their doorsteps with salt. Whatever they did made little difference in the end. 13 people from the farms in the village died that autumn. Their bodies were wrapped in blankets and left in outhouses and backyards until they could be taken to ground soft enough to bury them.
Now, let's start with the title of your new book, which is called Devil's Day, which is a tradition in the book, a sort of ritual that is performed sort of in the autumn time before the winter comes. Can you sort of explain what the idea of the Devil's Day is? And did you take bits of real traditions and stuff from the north to make it?
I was aware that Devil's Night is an American tradition that sort of corresponds to Mischief Night in Britain, which takes place on the night before Halloween. So I think that was probably sort of in my mind when I was writing this. But Devil's Day is something quite specific in the novel. It's a specific ritual that farmers go through at that time of year. And I suppose to explain that, I need to go back a little bit further to the start of the book, where it begins with a story, a folk story about the devil. So about 100 years before the sort of main narration in the novel, there is an outbreak of disease in the valley where the novel's set. And there's a terrible blizzard which kills a number of people. And the devil is blamed for both of those things. So the story goes that he disguises himself amongst the flock. The sheep are brought down off the moors, and the devil has sort of insinuated himself in amongst them. And he sort of wreaks havoc when he comes down to the valley. And so for the years after that, the farmers have to decide what they're going to do. So how are they going to prevent this from happening again? So what they do is that the day before they bring the sheep down, they lure the devil down from the moors with a bonfire and music and wine, and they get him drunk and they put him to sleep on the fire. So he's sleeping through this process of gathering the sheep. So by the time he wakes up, they're already safely in the byfield and he can't do any more harm. And so this ritual, this custom has become sort of a yearly thing that the farmers do. In the present day, there's no sort of literal belief in the devil. I think he becomes a sort of symbol for those forces that they can't control, so like the weather and disease, for example. And so I suppose I was trying to make a point that we're still prone to superstitious beliefs, even now.
Well, I mean, like, apart from the cars and sort of the little mentions of technology that exist in the book, I was thinking this book could have been set, you know, in the 19th century, and you possibly wouldn't even have to change that much.
That's true, yeah. I mean, that was the sort of feel that I wanted from the book, really, that it was, that time was quite sort of fluid, I suppose, though, really, that the past, the present, and the future all sort of exist sort of at the same moment, really, because there's a lot of talk about the Pentecost ancestors, that talk about the gaffer and his father, and they're always looking to the future as well about how the farms are going to continue and how important John and Kat's son will be to the future of the farms as well. So it's as if time sort of kind of all overlaps all the way through.
And so it starts with a narrator called John Pentecost, and he's brought his new wife, who's Kat, to the Endlands, which is where he grew up, for a funeral for the gaffer, who is his grandfather. And you basically can't really say much more than that without starting to spoil stuff, which is also sort of similar with the Loni as well, that you couldn't really bring up much about the plot apart from sort of saying where it was set and who was in it.
Yeah.
Landscape is so important in this book, like the Loni, and you've got the Loni was a location from your childhood, and the Endlands is sort of based on where you live now. Is that right?
More or less, yes. I think it's a novel that was sort of grown out of being quite restless, really. I get very itchy feet. I've spent so much time sort of walking and enjoying the natural world from being very, very young that it's just become sort of part of what I am, really, I guess. And I think it was trying to find somewhere that was quite wild and lonely, really, and a quite desolate place to go. And quite close to where I live as well. So I think it's the sort of proximity of that sort of loneliness and wilderness to where I live, which was quite appealing, really. So I've been able to spend quite a bit of time walking in a place called the Trough of Bowland, which is up between Preston and Lancaster. There's a big expanse of moorland in that area. And I suppose, like, the landscape of Loni, it was just really sort of startling place to experience, really. And as far as I knew, no one had really written about that area either. And it was particularly the moorland that really interested me. If you look on the map, the sort of further you go into the moorland, the kind of fewer things are named. And so it's a sort of place without language as well. Around the edges, there are lots of villages, as John says in the book. And the valley in the novel is very heavily mapped, and even very sort of specific things like river bends and cloughs and fell sides and paths have very particular names that have been passed down. But on the moorland, there's not very much that's named at all. And so that sort of absence of language, I thought, was really fascinating and made it a very sort of unsettling, uncanny sort of place.
I mean, and you're always really good at naming stuff, like naming places in such an unsettling. it's quite weird, because sometimes the words themselves aren't unsettling, but the sound of the word that you make is quite... Yeah. So I'm thinking of, like, Sullom Wood, which is very important in this book. But there's also Corpse Lane, which is pretty... It's sort of self-explanatory, but
yeah.
and even the Endlands, which kind of has a sort of finality to it,
sure.
Which is kind of scary as well. How do you choose how you're going to name your locations?
I mean, some of the places in the book are real. So Sullom Wood is a real place, and Fiendsdale Clough,
yeah.
Fiendsdale Fell is also a real place as well. So some of them are sort of taken from the actual sort of landscape of the moorland. I think it is to do with sound a lot of the time, particularly with, I suppose it's names that sort of suggest particular things. So there's a bend in the river called Sour Bend, for example, and things like Gutter Clough. So I mean, it's the kind of rhythm of those words, I think, that really interests me as well. And I think people's names are important as well. Like most writers, I'm a bit of a magpie, so if you kind of hear interesting names, they lodge away in your mind, or you write them down and you hang on to them. So it's like the name Pentecost, for example.
Yeah.
That was a name I saw, I think someone was giving a talk somewhere with that name, John Pentecost. I thought, that's a wonderful name, so I thought, I'll steal that and use it myself. But things like Beasley, for example, is a local Lancashire name, and Sturzica as well, one of the families that live in the village, as a local name. So it's trying to, I suppose, keep it sort of contained in that geography.
And I suppose, I mean, you seem to love ritual and tradition, and particularly, I mean, in The Lonely, there's both of your books basically build up around an event, the sort of anticipation of, and the sort of sense of dread that starts to build when you know the event is getting closer. So in this, it's Devil's Day. In The Lonely, there's the ceremony and the shrine to Kuahani,
yeah.
in The Lonely. What is it about ritual and tradition? Because I've spoken to you before, and you described yourself as a fairly lapsed Catholic. You were raised in a big Catholic family.
Very lapsed Catholic.
Very lapsed Catholic. And but you've still got that interest in religion and the imagery that religion has, and certainly lots of elements of paganism as well seem to come through in your books.
Definitely, yeah. I think I've spoken to a number of other lapsed Catholics about this as well. They've said very much the same thing, that it doesn't really ever leave you entirely, you know, that there is something, I think, quite appealing about ritual and mysticism, which is very much at the heart of the Catholic Mass. Yeah, it's just, I think it's just a fascination with the way that we deal with the unknown. And I think that's really what the ritual is in Devil's Day, really. It's a way of them having a pretense of some control over those forces that are arranged against them, so that they can map as much as they like in the valley. They can name things and have some sort of ownership and agency over certain features in the valley, and they can set up barricades to stop the river from overflowing, and they can channel the water in particular ways, and they can look after their sheep and fence them in and what have you. So they have a degree of control and understanding of the natural world, but it's very, very easy for the natural world to overpower them. And particularly in a place like that, you know, really kind of beholden to the weather and also disease as well. And so I thought, we still need to have ritual, I suppose, in order to feel that sense of control. Now, as I said before, I think the devil just becomes a sort of symbol for those forces. And so for at least for one night of the year, they can feel like they can control him and get on with their lives, really.
And I suppose with your narrator, John, he knows about this ritual and he knows how things work. But then his wife, Kat, she's very hesitant about everything she's seeing, and she learns a lot of things about her husband and also the people that raised him and the family friends that he knows. And there's also scenes with Adam, their son in the future,
yeah.
who kind of needs to be eased into his surroundings as well. He doesn't have the sort of familiarity, even though he's born into it, that John did. And I was wondering whether this is something that you go through as someone that loves environment and loves your surroundings, and perhaps with your children, do you have to sort of ease them into the environment? Because it's very easy to be scared of the natural landscape when you're a kid.
I think so, yeah. I don't know. It's a curious contradiction, I think, you feel when you're in that kind of environment. And I spent a lot of time in the valley where the novel is set, all different weathers, all different times of the year. And you do get a sense of sort of belonging there after a while. If it's familiar, then you feel sort of quite safe there, I think, in many ways. But at other times, you do feel quite vulnerable as well, and particularly when you sort of walk out of the valley and onto the moors, it's the space of them, I suppose, that is unusual, because you don't really see that sort of sense of distance and space and silence as well, you know, if you live in a town or a city. And so I think there is a feeling of belonging there. I think, you know, as a species, we've live with the land for thousands and thousands of years. You know, we've grown crops on it, and we've raised animals, we've worshipped it. We have a really, really close connection to the land. But I suppose, you know, maybe over the last 250 years or so, we've gradually been removed away from that. And so there is a remnant of that close connection that's still there. So, yeah, I think it's an odd sort of contradiction of feelings, really. I mean, I suppose I grew up going out into those kind of places anyway, so it feels very sort of natural in many ways. But I guess for someone like Kat in the novel, who's suddenly thrust into this place, it would be quite terrifying, you know, having to make sense of not only the people that you're with and their customs and their sort of hierarchies, but also the landscape as well.
Mm. It's strange, but there is a sort of particular British horror and sort of the tropes that are involved in building that. So things like landscape and weather, ritual, and sort of outsiders coming in onto something that they don't understand. The usual example is the Wicker Man, and I think the Loney got a lot of comparisons to the
did,
Wicker
yeah.
Man.
Which is
and
fine, that's okay.
And I'm kind of guessing that this probably is going to get that as well. but, I mean, do you dip into that sort of existing body of horror, or is this sort of entirely built out of your own interests, your own experiences, your own surroundings?
I think it must be partly. I'm certainly, you know, aware of those kinds of films. You know, I'm a big fan of films like The Wicker Man, for example. But I think it's that there is something really uncanny, or can be something really eerie about the English landscape. So, for example, I mean, like a film like A Field in England, Ben Wheatley's film, it's just an astonishing sort of film, really. But it's the idea that it possesses this kind of uncanniness, this sort of menace as well, that mm-hmm. I think is really, really interesting. I don't think I really sort of consciously try and fit it into any kind of tradition of writing. I think that I tend to sort of go from the landscape, really, and the people who live there, and see where the story sort of takes me from there, really. But I think there's certainly a real fascination with how people live with the landscape and how they shape it and how the landscape shapes them. And I think from that there is always a kind of uncanniness that comes out of that relationship.
Pre Loney, you started as a short story writer, and you've said before that you really love Raymond Carver and you love Hemingway and Cheever and Chekhov, but M.R. James as well.
Yes.
And I mean, your writing has a lot in common with M.R. James, particularly these little bursts of overt horror that sort of are laid in amongst a lot of sort of world building and sort of slow build of tension. How do you temper that? Because I feel there must be a lot of skill in knowing when to put these little bursts of supernatural activity and knowing when it's too much and going, oh, God, this is just becoming a bloodbath now. I really need to temper this back.
Yeah, it's, I think certainly the ending of The Loney, which I won't give away, but was probably the hardest bit to write, really, for that very reason about, you know, what do you leave in, what do you take out? And I knew with the ending of that novel that I just wanted it to be as if the reader saw through a crack in a wall, so just something horrific for a moment, and then it was gone. And I think I saw M.R. James does in a lot of his stories, something like A Whistle and I'll Come to You. Mm. You know, the very ending of that is just that moment of horror, the moment of paralysis for the protagonist. And I love that. I think those are the kinds of stories that really unsettle me and have stayed with me, really. Ones where you don't really see anything particular, or anything that you can really sort of label, anything you can really particularly understand. And so I suppose it's similar in Devil's Day as well. I don't know whether, again, it's a sort of conscious thing that I do, but I suppose it's, I should explain it really, but
well, I suppose there must be quite a lot of satisfaction in being able to scare people and unsettle them without really showing them very much.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's built up. I think that by the time they sort of get to that stage, they're already sort of unsettled by the place itself and by the people. But I think a lot of the horror comes from people, or perhaps as well as the supernatural. But so certainly I think that people in Devil's Day are, you know, horrific in their own right, and the way that they behave. I think particularly the children.
Yeah.
You know, there were flashbacks to John's childhood and his altercations with Lenny Sterzica, who's the kid who bullies him at school. And the way that they treat each other, the way that Lenny bullies him, and the way that Lenny is treated by his brother and his friends as well, there's just this immense amount of cruelty in childhood as well.
Mm.
So, I think that people often are the source of much of the horror in what I write.
And there's nothing scarier than weird kids.
Exactly, absolutely, right, yeah.
I mean, when I interviewed, when we spoke a while ago, you said that you knew exactly what happened at the end of The Loney, but you weren't going to say, and, you know, people just sort of had to decide. And I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say that Devil's Day has quite an open ending too. I mean, do you feel like you know what has happened?
Yes, I think so, yeah. But again, I think, going back to your question earlier, I think it's better to leave that open for people to interpret. the meaning of the ending and sort of where that potentially takes the characters after that. I think, yeah, quite a few people were not disappointed, but kind of, yeah, well, I suppose we were disappointed by the end by the ending of the learning that it wasn't all neatly tied up, really. And it's one of the questions that I'm asked quite a lot, you know, sort of what happens at the end of the learning? Do you know what happens
Have
at
you
the
ever
end of
told
learning?
Anyone?
No, I think I've always given the same sort of answer, really. So, whatever you think is the ending, that's the ending, really, and which is really sort of dissatisfying for a lot of people. But you know, the same amount of people have really liked the fact that it's not tied up, really. And I certainly, for me, those are definitely kinds of stories that I would want to read, really.
Mm. I mean, we're sort of getting into spooky season now because it's Halloween approaching. And I was wondering, is there a particular story, maybe an M.R. James story, that you feel like people should read this season? Or do you maybe another spooky tale by another author?
I think, yeah, M.R. James is always always a really, really good writer to read around Halloween. A number of times I've tried to read M.R. James stories to my children to scare them.
Does it work?
Sometimes it does. when they're a bit younger, perhaps. Yeah. So, something like A Whistle and I'll Come to You, I think, is a really great story. I think, in fact, if you could read the story, then watch the black and white film with Michael Horden, which I think is really almost as terrifying, I think, as the story itself. But something like A Warning to the Curious as well is a fantastic M.R. James story. So I think, yeah, those are the two that I'd recommend.
And when we talked last, you said that you're possibly working about a non-fiction book about solitude. And I was wondering if that's still in the works, because I remember telling people when everyone went, oh, that's a good topic.
it's still there on the back burner, yeah. I'm in a very nice position at the moment where I can sort of choose what I do next, really. So having finished Devil's Day, so yeah, I've got a number of different ideas about what I want to write next. But certainly that fascination with the countryside and the natural world is still there. So I'm sure it'll be something along those lines.
Oh, I do like a bit of gothic as the nights draw in and the spiders take over the garden. Sian, you're coming from Australia, so you probably don't know the spider time of year.
Yeah, no, we made up the spider thing just to keep all the British out.
So all the way back to the 18th century, there's been hot gothic and cold gothic. Think of Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner versus Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, or in today's currency, I guess, Karen Russell's Louisiana Swamp gothic versus Michelle Paver's Arctic Chillers. What are your favourites, Sian?
Well, I am a huge fan of Shirley Jackson, particularly The Haunting of Hill House, which has had a lot of parodies based on it over recent years, and particularly in Hollywood. But it's such a good book, and it could be hammy in any other writer's hands, but she's so good. And there's a recent collection of her short stories by Penguin called Dark Tales, which has a short story in it that I think is possibly one of the scariest things I've read. And it's scary because you don't actually know what's going on. You sort of are left to decide what has happened and what is happening and what's going to happen in your own head. It's called Paranoia, and it revolves around a man who goes to buy a present for his wife's birthday. And as he leaves the store, he notices that there's a man wearing a light-coloured hat who starts just appearing everywhere he goes as he tries to make his way home. And it is so scary. It's brilliant. And it's only maybe 8 pages long, but she just packs so much into those 8 pages. I'm so impressed by her.
One of the interesting things about ghost stories is how they reflect the age in which they're written, isn't it? And the sort of golden age was late Victorian, or late 19th century, early 20th century, when they actually did believe in ghosts. You think of Conan Doyle and his ectoplasm, and Yeats and his theosophy and his occult.
Well, I suppose the thing with Shirley Jackson, the way it works, is that no one has a mobile phone. You don't just go call your wife and go, there's a weirdo following me on my home, can you get me out of this situation? Or call the cops or something. You know, you need that sort of inability to just communicate whenever you want. I mean, like, novelists always complain that mobile phones kind of ruin the novel, but it would certainly ruin a lot of these horror stories if they just had an easy way out.
I wonder whether that's why a lot of ghost stories now are set in the past.
Yeah.
You know, people like Helen Dunmore, the late lamented Helen Dunmore, fantastic historical ghost stories. Or one of my favourites is Michelle Paver, who writes, who's best known for her YA books about the Chronicles of Ancient Darkness. But actually, she's done some fantastic Arctic and Himalayan stories about intrepid adventurers in the 1930s. Discovering forces of darkness.
You need that sort of enforced darkness, so lots of candlelight, so no electricity, and no internet, no phones, basically. It keeps it frightening.
Do you actually find them frightening?
I do. I mean, I find it more frightening. So the other night I was rereading Paranoia, and my partner started talking to me and I sort of put my hand up to stop him because I was about a paragraph away from the end, and that's that sort of awful thing when someone takes you out of a story as you were about to finish it. And he sort of stood there and watched me as I was finishing it, and then I just went, ooh. And he was like, what was that? And I was like, that was me being scared. You know, that's the extent of my scare. Like, I'm not frightened of gore. I'm not frightened of sort of supernaturally things like zombies or, you know, that sort of thing. But I'm frightened more of the psychological side of things. So yeah. This idea that, for example, in paranoia, that there's someone, you don't know what their intent is, but the idea that it might be malicious and that they've got somehow this ability to always be pursuing you is just so frightening. But you don't know whether he's going to stab him or not. You never see it in the story. That's not a spoiler, but yeah, it's sort of the absence of explanation frightens me more than anything else.
Yeah, the thing I really like, I was thinking about what it was that drew me to a particular style of story, and I think for me it's the sense of the environment being the untamable, the unknowable, the bigger than you. And how you deal with that. And actually the master of that is a guy called Algernon Blackwood, who was hugely prolific, a short story writer in the early part of the 20th century. And he's always sending his characters out into Canadian wilds where they, you know, they confront this possibly mythical being who, of course, until the end, you don't know whether it's actually going to happen. Or he has people eaten by trees.
Oh, cool.
It's so cool. So it's, in a way, they're not exactly ghost stories, but it's the whole of nature is this spectral, dangerous thing, which I think really chimes with today because, you know, we're living in a state of environmental collapse, and that is very scary. What the dangerous things, the hurricanes and the tidal waves and things that can get unleashed by our abusive environment.
I mean, there's so many of the stories now that I think about it that I like are usually some of the limitation that's placed on the protagonist is due to the environment being remote. So there's a particular, it's weird to call it horror because I think it's quite a literary book, but the Kobe Abe is The Woman in the Dunes. And this idea that this man comes to this village and is basically tricked into going into this dune where this woman lives, and they take away the ladder. So he thinks he's only down there temporarily, and then the people that took him there take away the ladder and he's trapped down there and is basically forced to accept that he now has to live with this woman forever down in this dune. And a lot of sort of other things happen, but it's a part of that horror is that even if he gets out of that dune, what does he do? And the people that took him there, they can't have him telling everyone what they did to him. So it's the sort of little storylines that never happen that you can imagine that make it frightening as well.
And Murakami does that very well too, doesn't he?
There's a particular book by him called Dance, 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 which is not a horror novel, but there's a lot of tropes in it, like lots of dark hotel corridors and stuff like that, which make it a bit spooky. And there's a particular scene that involves some skeletons that I really remember freaking me out.
And he wrote a fantastic story about a woman who gets married to an Iceman. And again, they go off to the Arctic. Again, I think I might be a bit obsessed with the Arctic, really. The Arctic, having grown up in hot places, the idea of the Arctic is my idea of horror. Just we don't need any ghosts in it or monsters.
But the opposite of that is Australia as well. I mean, there's a couple of years ago, there was The Natural Way of Things by Charlotte Wood, which got very much promoted and reviewed as a sort of feminist novel, but it's absolutely a horror novel. And set in the Australian outback, so again, remote location, where a bunch of women wake up and realise that they've all been taken to this outback shearing shed where a couple of men and a woman ruling the area, and it's too remote for them to escape. They have their hair shaved and their clothes removed. They have to wear these sort of old sort of Victorian gowns as they work on the land. And it's all sort of about the power dynamic that forms because these women become warped by the misogyny or with which they're treated, and they start turning on each other, they turn on their captors, they start pursuing their captors sexually because it gives them a bit of power back. It's horrific, and it has quite a bleak ending. I won't spoil what happens, but it's that sort of absence of hope as well that can be quite haunting.
One of my favourites is Sarah Waters' The Little Stranger. Have you read that?
No.
Oh my goodness, you've got a treat in store. And that is one of the tropes of the ghost story is, as I think I said a bit early on, it's about history. And it's set just after the Second World War, when in a big house, at the point at which big houses are becoming unsustainable, they're sort of ghostly, empty. They are inhabited by their past. There is no future for them. And all around it, all these new estates are happening. And it's so spooky. And part of the... I've sort of spent ages trying to analyse what it is about good ghostwriting that is so entrancing in a technical sense. And I think often it's that the actual writing is very factual and concrete. And in the writing of very concrete sentences and scenarios, you sort of create an ectoplasm between the lines, if you like. Let's just have a little listen to the opening of The Little Stranger, and I think you might see what I mean.
I first saw Hundreds Hall when I was 10 years old. It was the summer after the war, and the Ayreses still had most of their money then, were still big people in the district. The event was an Empire Day fete. I stood with a line of other village children making a Boy Scout salute while Mrs. Ayres and the Colonel went past us handing out commemorative medals. Afterwards we sat to tea with our parents at long tables on what I suppose was the south lawn. Mrs. Ayres would have been 24 or 25, her husband a few years older. Their little girl, Susan, would have been about 6. They must have made a very handsome family, but my memory of them is vague. I recall most vividly the house itself, which struck me as an absolute mansion. I remember its lovely aging details, the worn red brick, the cockled window glass, the weathered sandstone edgings. They made it look blurred and slightly uncertain. Like an ice, I thought, just beginning to melt in the sun.
That was Richard Lee reading the first paragraph of The Little Stranger. And we only managed to lure Richard into the studio. Richard is phobic about horror, I think he will admit. He's a wimp. We only managed to lure him in with the promise that actually there is nothing obviously scary about this, as there often isn't in the setup. And that raises an interesting thing about the inability to control one's reading and the fact that, you know, the sense of helplessness you get, basically.
Well, I am a proper sook. When I get scared, I really get scared. And this has always been the case, whether it's books or film or TV, that when something bothers me, it bothers me for ages. But I quite like that. I like being scared. Mm. And I find it interesting. And there's a very sort of cold, detached part of my mind that when I am scared goes, oh, why are you scared? And sort of likes to look at why. And, I mean, there's some things that go too far. I mean, this is a sort of distinction between book and film, but there is a book by Stephen King, and I don't read a lot of Stephen King because I tried reading it and it freaked me out for ages and I never finished it. But there's another book, it's a novella called The Mist, and that is a fantastic book. And it is again frightening because of the absence of information. You don't know what is out in the mist, but something's out there and it's taking people, and the bulk of it is set in a supermarket. Now, read the book. Do not watch the film, because the film has a different ending and the film will mess you up forever. Like, I can say that I watched it about 10 years ago, and for those 10 years, I've been messed up about the ending of that film.
Don't watch it. I'd say the same about Daphne du Maurier's Don't Look Now, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the film is beautiful in its own right, but the novella is so perfect, so perfectly crafted. Well, it's so scary. And again, it's about the unknowability of Venice and these sort of dark streets and what is there, that the menace that you don't understand.
So interesting that a lot of these are short stories and novellas.
It's but that's ideally
good in a little chunk.
Ideally, because there's a sort of one story, isn't there? Yeah. Generally, I mean, so The Little Stranger is an exception because it's a novel which happens to have hung itself on a ghost story. But if you're telling a ghost story, they sort of have an impetus that takes you a certain length. Mm. And then you want to stop.
I mean, there's I quite like a lot of what might be called sort of feminist body horror. So you've got usually a female main protagonist, and something to do with their gender inspires self-harm, which can be really upsetting, but also really interesting in sort of how you explore female attitudes to body and sex and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And particularly, I was thinking like Margaret Atwood's The Edible Woman, which is teeny tiny. Not really horror, but it's quite unsettling. There's also people like Helen Oyeyemi and also Daisy Johnson, who had a short story collection out last year called Fen, which has quite a lot of body horror and people turning into animals, and again set in Lancashire, like Andrew McElhurley. So I think that's a really interesting body. It's a little area of horror as well.
Mm. Angela Carter did that as well. I mean, she's got fantastic, her use of dolls.
Yeah.
I've never actually been able to look a doll in the face since reading Angela Carter. They changed their meaning for me. Well, that's enough goosebumps, I think, for one Halloween. Andrew Michael Hurley's Devil's Day is out now, published by John Murray, and we'll have a list on the podcast page of some of the works, other works we've talked about. Next week, we hear from Salman Rushdie, whose eerily prescient novel The Golden House examines a world where a media-savvy villain embarks on a crass presidential campaign that turns America upside down. Now, why does that sound so familiar?
There are
thousands of podcasts in the Guardian archive on politics, science, technology, global development and more. You can find them all at theguardian.com/podcasts. We're there as well, of course. Or you can find us by just opening up your favourite podcast app and searching for Guardian Books Podcast. You can join the conversation either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead.
Me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian. Goodbye. And thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Ooh.